You are tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio on 90.7 FM. This is the first episode of our 2022 Women's Month series. It's a part of our All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. This series will be on at 6 on Fridays for all of March, so come back next week too. I'm Althea, and I have two great archival pieces to share with you today. First, we'll be enjoying a 2010 episode of Black Book Talk. Once again, you're listening to KBOO's Women's Month series. Thanks for being with us. Let's dive in.
You're listening to KBOO-FM. This is Black Book Talk for March 2010. I'm Patricia Welch, one of your co-hosts. In March of 2003, when Operation Iraqi Freedom was only days old, world headlines were made when a U.S. Army convoy was attacked in the city of An Nasiriyah, en route to Baghdad. Several soldiers were killed and others were taken prisoner. Jessica Lynch became the name and face associated with this tragedy, but another female soldier, Shoshana Johnson, was also wounded and captured in the ambush. A video of Shoshana being interrogated by her captors was soon broadcast on Spanish language television and then picked up by American media. Shoshana had become the first black female prisoner of war in United States history. She was held for 22 days. When Shoshana returned to the United States, she received numerous awards for her valor, including the Bronze Star, Purple Heart, and Prisoner of War medals. She appeared on news networks and national television shows. She was still unable to discuss what really happened in Iraq until now. Shoshana Johnson is the author of a book called I'm Still Standing, and it tells the story of what happened to her in Iraq, and more importantly, what has happened to her since. We are very pleased to welcome Shoshana Johnson to Black Book Talk. I hope you're on the line. Ms. Johnson, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, and I want to say that my co-host, Emma Jackson Ford, is, I believe, also on the line. Emma, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Wonderful. Okay. I'm so happy that you're here, and certainly for Women's History Month, and this is the end of Black History Month, and what you did was really historic, not just being the first African-American woman to be a prisoner of war, but to stand up and speak about what happened and what the experience has been for you. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened during your time in Iraq?
Well, it was the first days of the conflict. We were on our way to Baghdad when our convoy was ambushed. As you said earlier, 11 soldiers were killed, and myself and five others were taken, four others were taken as prisoners of war. You know, we were moved several times during our captivity, interrogated, and after 22 days of wondering day after day if we were going to survive, we were rescued by the United States Marine Corps.
Wow.
Okay, and what happened when you returned home? How did you feel about it? What was it like?
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me? Okay, we were wondering, tell us a little bit more about what happened once you were freed and once you came home. Let me see. Ms. Johnson, Shoshana, are you hearing us? Okay, audience members, it seems like for some reason there's a missing connection and our guest isn't hearing us. Let's see, Emma, are you still on the line?
I'm here. I'm thinking maybe she'll reconnect in a moment.
Okay, I'm certainly hoping so. But while she is, I want to mention something, and Emma, you can weigh in on this too. I was very surprised to realize that she and Jessica Lynch, or to be reminded that they were in the same convoy that was attacked. This was a smaller part of a larger group. Ms. Johnson was a cook, and I think a lot of the people in there were like non-combat troops. They found that they'd gone to the wrong place, and by the time they turned around and had to go back into the city and got lost, I mean, they were just sitting there. And I remember reading something in which she said that when she looked around, the people that she saw firing on her were not her image of what an army would be, not the image of the people who would be, quote-unquote, the enemy. These were just folks in tennis shoes and shirts and jeans, you know, just people. Okay, great. People from the community. Hi. Okay. Can we call you Shoshana?
Shoshana is fine.
Shana?
Yeah.
Okay, that's even better. Great. We're happy that you're back. We were just kind of talking about what happened. And one of the things that I said is that I had sort of forgotten, or I'm not even sure if I realized that you and Jessica Lynch were a part of the same convoy.
Yes, we're in the same company.
Okay, because there was so much media about her and so much media about what she supposedly did, and then we found out that was not quite true, and sort of a splash of media about you, but not quite the same. How does that come to be, that two people who are in the same company and have the same experience have sort of different receptions when they get back?
Well, during our when we were captured, we were separated. She was kept in a hospital in Nasiriyah.
Okay.
And myself and the men were moved to Baghdad. So our rescues were different and at different times.
Okay.
And yes.
I was going to say, and the fact that you went there not as a combatant, but you went there to cook, what were you expecting beforehand?
Well, you have to understand, whether you're a cook or a secretary or a nurse, a soldier is a soldier. You're trained as a soldier first. I knew how to fire my weapon, throw a grenade, and so forth. So I think sometimes people get the misconception that although we have a secondary job, that our secondary job means that we're not trained just soldiers, and that's not true. Now, was I trained as a infantry or armor, a combat-related soldier? No. But and I really didn't think I would ever see combat the way I did. But, you know, being in the military is a dangerous job. I don't want people to get the wrong idea and think that you can ever be, quote-unquote, safe when you're in the military. Every aspect of the military job is dangerous.
You had a 2-year-old daughter when you went into the military. Would that be correct? Or simply when you went to Iraq?
When I went to Iraq.
Okay, but why did you choose to go into the military? Because it is dangerous. It is dangerous.
Well, I come from a military family. My dad did 20 years. My sister was on active duty at the same time as I myself. Cousins, aunts, uncles. So the military was not something new to me.
Okay.
And I also wanted college money and the experience, you know. You get to do a lot of different things and encounter a lot of different people when you're in the military. And I definitely think it helped me grow as a person.
Okay. Then why did you leave? Because not that long after coming back to the States, you resigned, right?
I requested a medical discharge about a couple months after I got home. You know, I originally thought I could finish out my 20-year career and, you know, get the culinary education that I wanted so badly, but the physical and mental issues that I was dealing with was a little too much, and just dealing with military life on top of that was not easy.
But tell us a little bit more. I mean, it would seem that you would have been a war hero and that, gosh, you know, I mean, that your path would have been set and very, very easy given all that you had been through.
Well, no. Just because of what happened doesn't give me a pass on everything. But I did encounter some resentment because of the attention I was given. And when you're trying to recover with PTSD, you know, that doesn't help.
Post-traumatic stress syndrome?
Disorder.
Disorder, okay. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, what the experience was like when you returned?
Well, there was a lot of attention as far as the media, and, I had to deal with the physical wounds. I was shot in both legs, and, just dealing with the fact that we lost 11 people,
okay.
That I did spend that time in captivity, and I wasn't the same person that left. It was a hard road, not just for myself, but for my family, too, because I think they really expected the same Shauna that left to be the one that came back, and that person's gone.
Have you been able to recover from most of it?
Physically, somewhat. I mean, I still have a lot of problems with my legs, a lot of scar tissue, nerve damage, things like that. Mentally, it's an ongoing process. I still go to therapy. I still deal with nightmares and flashbacks, but it has gotten better. And I feel with my continued therapy that I will be okay eventually.
And does the military cover that in terms of recognition that you do have this and making sure that you get all the medical treatment that you have, that you need?
Yes, it wasn't a fight in the beginning. At first, they didn't really want to acknowledge that I had PTSD. And I had to fight them on it. Mm-hmm. But it is in my medical records. It is a fact. I do get therapy from the Army and VA to help me deal with my issues.
Good.
I think the last thing they want to see is on television, former POW, loses her fight with PTSD or something like that. So they do step up to the plate and help.
Have you been able to use your benefits to go to culinary school?
Yes, I'm in culinary school at the moment. I'm studying to become a pastry chef, and I plan to use every bit of my GI Bill. So if I finish culinary school and there's still something left, I'll go back and learn about restaurant management and keep on going until it's all gone.
How old is your daughter now?
Oh, she's nine. Gonna be 10 in May. Driving me crazy.
Does she have ambitions to grow up and be a military person?
Well, if she wanted to, I would always leave that open to her. We'd definitely sit down and talk about, what it's really like to be in the military. Mm-hmm. You know, those nice commercials with Gary Sinise and that voiceover mm-hmm. about making you Army strong mm-hmm. is very nice, but it's not necessarily everything that you need to know when you join the military. So I definitely sit down with her and let her know what it's really about. And if she still chose to do it, then I would support her 110%. But at the moment, she's like not into it at all.
I don't know if you heard it, but at the introduction to the interview, we played a segment of, was it Don't You Remember Me? By Jill Scott. One, because we heard that you like Jill Scott, and two, because in reading some of the things that I had read about you, I kind of wondered, not just for you, but if the military really did remember the people who were out there. I mean, your situation was seen around the world, and yet when you came back, I hate to say it, but I just had the impression that some of your colleagues were just a little petty about the fact that you were getting, I don't know, what is it, you got ringside seats at a Oscar De La Hoya fight,
yes.
And that some of the upper brass were a little surprised and dismayed that you were showing up at very shishi-poo-poo, as Oprah would say, events that they were at. But I'm thinking, this is pretty darn petty when somebody's been in Iraq. They were a prisoner of war. I thought, comported yourself beautifully. I remember hearing you say something like, you really didn't want to be a crying female. So I just kind of felt like you had done your part, and that when you came back, not only should you have been given support for any physical ills that you had, but that, the service should have stepped up and made sure that you and everybody else, not just you, but that everybody else had every bit of support that you needed to get. And to hear that some of your fellow service people were upset because you got attention and they didn't, I was very disappointed to hear that.
It was very disappointing, and it was hard. I never in a million years thought some of my fellow soldiers would be so petty. And I remember that same gentleman that complained about me going to the De La Hoya fight, years later, I ran into him. Two or three years later, I ran, and he was still upset about that fight. And I'm like, let it go, man. You know, and then, you know, that's when I started to say, I was like, you know what, I feel sorry for you. You can't go on with who you need to be and what you need to accomplish in your life to make you happy. You're still worried about what happened years ago, about my special moment years ago. I was like, that's sad. You are real sad.
I want to say that I am really glad that you wrote a book. When I told my students about what I was going to be doing today and told them about you, uh-huh. I mean, some of the girls' eyes were like, because I don't think they had thought of going to the military as an option before. They were very excited about hearing this. I'm really glad you wrote this book. But I want to ask, why did you decide to write?
Well, it was a combination of things. First, you know, my family was on me to write it from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, I love y'all, but just because y'all think that people want to read my story doesn't mean it's necessarily true. You know, they're very supportive, very loving, and, you know, they think the best.
Yes.
I'm like, I don't know. But after a while, I began to hear so many different stories about what happened from people who were nowhere near Iraq, mm-hmm. nowhere near Nazaria, and want to tell me what happened to me. So I really needed to put the truth out there from my point of view, and so I can have some peace of mind about the information that's out there. I want people to understand the truth.
Well, I saw a YouTube clip of you on CNN. Let me see. Dr. Phil was there, and another person who was a JAG officer, and I don't remember his name. No, I thought you were excellent, and I looked at some of the comments, and a lot of people thought the same thing. But, you know, I just think that your fellow servicemen and women should be so proud of you, especially the ones who are not officers, because I thought you represented them so well. But could you give us a little background on this, how this came about, and just tell folks what happened that evening, especially in terms of somebody not being there, being the expert, and you being there, and they not even recognizing that you're the expert? Ugh.
Well, first of all, I felt bad because I lost my temper.
I'm glad you did. And you didn't appear to lose your temper. I thought it was a little righteous indignation, but I thought you handled it well. But I'm sorry, go on. Let me let you talk.
I don't regret anything I said. I back what I said completely, but I felt I should have controlled my temper a little bit. But, what you know, the Fort Hood situation, and they were, you know, this JAG officer, and I really...
Would you tell people what a JAG officer is?
It's just basically an Army attorney. He specializes in military law and things like that. And he was a defense attorney for the Army. And he made a comment that, you know, we should make assumptions by this man's last name, that he was a terrorist. And then there was some talk about maybe he was dealing with some mental issues. And he made the comment that because he was an officer, not some lower enlisted, that he should be able to deal with the stresses of combat and all that kind of stuff. And I was really upset, first of all, because you never make a judgment based on anybody's last name, their religion, or their color. And as attorney for the United States Army, he should have known better than to make a nasty little comment like that. And second, how can he assume, because of someone's education, that they can't succumb to the stresses of combat, or even as a medical professional, listening to soldiers 24/7 talk about their issues in Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, some violent things that happen? How can you not think that they would succumb to some of the stress of that? He was just really being ignorant.
He was. And what did he say? He asked you if you had been in Iraq?
Had I ever been to Iraq?
Oh.
And that, I think to me, that just showed he really was all about himself. Everyone was introduced at the beginning of the interview segment. I knew his name, Tom. And, you know, because we were introduced, he didn't bother to pay attention because it was all about him. And that's really sad, and I hope that you know, someone sat him down and spoke to him, because it bothers me to think that there could be a soldier in trouble and this is the man that's going to defend them.
Well, actually, though he was sitting, I kind of felt that you sat him down and got him straight in the nicest way when you just said that, you know, you were a prisoner of war. Yes, you had been there. And I don't know, there was another part of it where you said something like, you know, that he should not ever, I don't know, compare your experience to his or something. I don't remember the exact words, but I just said, you know, for all the enlisted people, for all the non-officers, hooray for you that you spoke up for them. I thought it was great, and I thought you did look indignant, and I thought that you should have been indignant. I mean, oh. No, I really encourage all the people who are listening this morning, go to www.youtube.com and put in Shoshana Johnson and CNN and look at that clip.
Oh, my God.
Because I felt that it said a lot about you and your integrity, that you weren't just going to sit there. That, you know, sometimes you have to speak the truth, and sometimes you have to speak it forcefully and clearly. And I thought you did an excellent job.
Well, thank you.
I really did.
Yeah. I unfortunately, some people like to take away things what they may. There was some people that thought I was supporting or defending the gentleman in Fort Hood. I'm like, no, that's not the case at all. You know, whatever punishment he gets, he deserves. You know, he took the lives of a lot of soldiers. But that is no reason for anybody to start judging others based on their religion or their last name.
Well, now, Nicholas. What do you want the next phase of your life to be? What's next for you?
Definitely finishing school. You know, I want to finish culinary school and maybe do some catering, you know, wedding cakes, quinceanera cakes, that kind of thing. That's my thing. You know, I would love to have more kids. You know, not a single parent thing again, because that's hard. You know, I want young girls to understand that's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
That is a lot of work. But, you know, if it comes along, it does. If it doesn't, then, you know, there's other things out there for me. I have, you know, I'm an American. There's so much I can do. You know, I have so many opportunities open to me, and sometimes you just need to sit back, think about it, and then go for it.
Good.
Do you see yourself in a big city in the U.S. working as a, I'm not sure which, do I call it a cook or
pastry chef? No, I don't see, I like my small town America. I live in El Paso, Texas, and I like traveling to bigger cities, but I also love coming home.
Yeah.
But you've been traveling to a lot of cities. What's it been like to be an author, be on the road? Because you've been going to a lot of different places.
It's been a lot. You know, I am so grateful that I didn't attempt to do this when I first came home, because it takes a lot out of you, and there's no way mentally I would have been able to handle all of this when I first came home. No way. So it's been fun, you know,
mm-hmm.
a lot of shishi hotels and stuff like that. But it's also wonderful to come home to my daughter, my dogs. I have three dogs, and my parents who live around the corner.
So you're not going to give up the quiet life and just be on the road and on television all the time?
No, and you know what? That when I was in the military, I spent a lot of time away. I missed her first birthday, her first steps, and now I get to see, like, every little thing. So, it's real nice, and, you know, maybe I will get to do some other things, you know, do a little segment, cooking segment or something like that, but it has to be spaced properly so I could come home and spend time with my daughter.
Your book came out 2 weeks ago?
February 2nd.
Okay. So, about 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
How has it been received?
I've got a lot of good reviews. I really haven't had any bad reviews. Any at all. You know, so I've been very blessed. You know, I've also, you know, I would love to get it, like, on the bestsellers list so I could pay my mortgage. That'd be cool. I am the average American. I just want to pay off my mortgage and put my daughter's college money away.
Yeah.
So that would be nice. But as long as people enjoy reading it and get something from it, I'm happy.
One other thing. Are you in touch with Jessica Lynch? Because there was at some point, I think, some controversy about the fact that while you had to fight for your benefits, she did not. And while there was like a brief moment for your story, that there was this whole big media construction for her, which in fact wasn't even the truth, but it went on for a long time. So did that at all affect your relationship? Did you get to know her, friends?
We were friends before. We've been friends all this time. I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago. Actually, when the book first came out, and now it's having some issues because, you know, some people made some nasty comments after an article on AOL. And I talked to her, and I was like, you know, how do you deal with this? You know, Lynch got some hate mail at one point. You know, a lot of things said about her. And I was like, you know, how do you go on? And she was like, you know what? We were there, they weren't, and, you know, what it comes down to is no matter what they say, we got to go on with our lives, and we know the truth of what we did. So she was like, you're a strong woman, you'll be fine, you'll be all right. And, you know, she's right. I was there. No one can tell me what happened.
And you are a strong woman because you've come through this. But, I mean, I just personally, and I'm sure speaking for a lot of people, want to say, one, thank you. To you and all the service people who are over there protecting things for those of us who are not. We appreciate you, we respect you, and you have our support.
Well, thank you very much.
And further, thank you for being willing to tell your story.
Thank you very much. It was hard, but I think, you know, putting the truth out there makes a difference to me. And for anyone listening, you know, I just wanted to say, Bake Me a Wish is an organization. They you could order birthday cakes and stuff from them offline. And for the last, what is it, about 2 years now, they have taken 5% of all their proceeds and donated it toward having birthday cakes flown out to Iraq and Afghanistan for soldiers. And I think that's really wonderful. I think the best thing any individual can do is find your own way to contribute to those who are deployed. You know, it's really hard being away from family and friends, and when you hear that someone you don't know just sends you a card, says a thank you, it means the world.
Could you give us your website? Because I know you have some information about that on your website, so if people want to know more, what should they do?
ShoshanaJohnson.com.
Okay, good. Well, we are wrapping up Black Book Talk for March. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us. And we hope that you will be in Portland soon. We'll be looking forward to that.
Oh, maybe. Never know.
Okay. Well, this is Patricia Welch, the Library Lady.
And Emma Jackson Ford, Book Woman.
And we are saying good reading to all of you. Good books. Read something. Read this book, first of all. I'm Still Standing by Shoshana Johnson, published by Simon & Schuster. And have a good Women's History Day. We're going to go back to a little bit of Jill Scott, and we will see you next month.
If you're just tuning in, this is KBOO's Women's Month series on every Friday at 6 in this lovely month of March. We just heard an archival episode of Black Book Talk from 2010. Our hosts interviewed author and the first Black prisoner of war in U.S. history, Shoshana Johnson. Her book is called I'm Still Standing, From Captured U.S. Soldier to Free Citizen, My Journey Home. Next, we'll hear a 2009 episode of Political Perspectives. This is KBOO's Women's Month series. Stay right here.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. My guest is Michelle Goldberg, who argues that many of the world's most pressing issues can be tied to the question of who controls a woman's body. In her new book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World, Michelle Goldberg examines the backlash against modernization and globalization, which is happening around the world, and results in threats to women and their societies. Michelle Goldberg has been interviewed on KABU about her previous book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. She's an investigative journalist and a former senior writer at Salon.com. Michelle, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back.
In your previous book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, you documented how Christian fundamentalism gained a prominent role in American politics and how it was tied financially and ideologically to the Republican Party. How did you go from that topic to the global war on women's reproductive rights?
Well, reproductive rights were actually the issue that first interested in me in politics as a teenager. And so it was because I was interested in reproductive rights that I became interested in the fundamentalist movement that opposed them, and then went on to spend many years reporting on various aspects of the fundamentalist, Christian fundamentalist movement domestically. So in a way, it was coming back to my, origins, you would say. But also, when I was reporting about the Christian right and its role in the Bush administration, when I worked at Salon, and then when I went on to write my book, I really started to see two things. One was that the kind of canary in the coal mine, or the first signs of how much the previous administration was going to be influenced by the religious right. You could see it more immediately and starkly in terms of foreign policy than you could domestically. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, it's hard to remember now, but George Bush came into office, people thinking that he was something of a moderate and kind of conciliatory figure. And some of the first signs about how much enthrall and how much a part of this movement he was going to be came with things like the reinstitution of the global gag rule, later the cutting off of funding to the United Nations Population Fund. This is a pattern that goes way back. Basically, Republican politicians make a lot of promises to the anti-abortion movement, and there's only so much they can do to fulfill them domestically. Both, they're constrained by Roe versus Wade. They're also constrained by the realities of the fact that this is a country where slim majorities and sometimes ambivalent and tentative majorities, but majorities nonetheless, do not want to see abortion outlawed. And so the international realm is a realm in which Republican presidents can pay off their base basically without causing too much of an uproar here at home. And then finally, some of the groups that I wrote about in Kingdom Coming started to really internationalize their operations. They got accreditation at the United Nations, which was really ironic because many of them also talk about the United Nations as the seat of the Antichrist. Nevertheless, they started working in various international institutions, even making some really interesting alliances across religious lines with fundamentalists in other societies, which I thought was very telling.
One main focus of your book, The Means of Reproduction, is this whole idea that the subject of reproductive rights is a central issue. And often the subject of women's reproductive rights is put into the women's issue category off to the side, or subordinate to major issues like the economy and trade and all the things that we're focusing on right now. How do you view its importance in shaping the world?
So it's something that used to be actually pretty obvious to many, many commentators actually at the kind of center of American politics. You know, one of the things I write about in the book is that in the 50s and 60s, there was a great deal of concern shading into panic about overpopulation. Populations were growing very, very quickly in the developing world for a number of different reasons. And kind of national security types, pillars of the establishment, the founder of the Dixie Cup Company, a whole bunch of other figures became convinced that overpopulation was going to cause so much misery in the developing world that it was going to lead to communist revolution, and became obsessed with, you know, bringing contraception and even safe abortion to the four corners of the globe. That got lost later for a whole range of reasons that I go into in the book. But there's been, for quite a long time, an obvious connection between population and reproductive rights. Although at the time, it used to be about population control rather than about women's rights. But that's one of the more obvious things, right? Women who are educated, who have access to family planning, access to good sex education, who have a measure of power within their own families and relationships, have smaller families at a time when, you know, the world population is going to substantially exceed 9 billion people by 2050. There's all kinds of ways in which lower population growth is desirable for environmental reasons and also desirable for the futures of countries like, you know, like Bangladesh, like Nigeria, countries that just don't have the resources to cope with their rapidly growing population. That's an obvious one. Maybe a less obvious one would be in terms of economic development. Lawrence Summers, who is certainly, you know, no great radical feminist, when he was at the World Bank, would make the point that there is no greater investment that a country can make in its future than investing in the education of girls, both because of its second order effects in terms of family planning and smaller families, but also because of the way that education transfers to children. It substantially improves children's health. It substantially lowers child and infant mortality. Even more so, for example, than raising the income of a husband, raising the education of a woman has an even more profound effect on the welfare of her children because she's more able to demand family resources to be directed towards her children. She's less intimidated by doctors for a whole host of reasons. And the same goes for women who work outside the home. They tend to have more control over family resources in very poor countries, which they then are more likely to direct towards their children typically than men are. Not universally, but, you know, this is what all of the studies show. And so essentially, when you have women who have control over their own bodies and over their own reproductive destinies and over their own destinies, period, you end up with families that are smaller, healthier, and better educated. When women don't have that kind of control, you end up with families that are larger, sicker, and more desperate. And so it's really obvious how one of these is a recipe for social stability and the other is a recipe for ongoing social disintegration.
You even go into how the absence of women's rights or women's control, in a way, not only overpopulation and underpopulation, but sex ratio imbalances, how that eventually leads to great social problems.
Right. This is a huge problem in East Asia right now, where because of this concern over overpopulation that was taken very seriously, first by India and later by China, both of these countries, along with several other in East Asia, were obsessed with getting their birth rates down. India did it coercively with the emergency under Indira Gandhi, and later on China also adopted even more large-scale coercive programs around the one-child policy. In India, right now, they don't have overt coercion, although there are in many places systems of rewards and incentives to have smaller families. But they have succeeded in transforming social ideals about what an ideal family size is. But they never made a similar effort to transform social ideals about women's roles and women's rights. So as a result, in India, you have people who want smaller families. They want one or two children in many parts of the country. But one, at least one, and possibly both, have to be boys. So you have an epidemic of sex selective abortion. In China, you have an epidemic of sex selective abortion because of the one-child policy. And, you know, people who are only allowed to have one child want to make sure that they have an heir. And of course, this is exacerbated by policies in certain parts of China that say, well, if your first child is a girl, then you can go for another one. And so anyway, what's happening now is that you're going to have in all of these countries this very distorted generation, a generation that has so many more boys than girls that it's really a recipe for social instability. You know, and there's some sociological research on the effect of societies in which there are more men than women, and unmarriageable men are kind of prime recruits for various kind of destabilizing militias or terrorist groups or whatever have you. And although you might think, and it might be nice to think, that these dynamics would increase the value of women in a kind of supply and demand sense, it turns out that that's not at all the case. Instead, what happens is there's even more pressure on women to fulfill the role of wives and mothers because there's less wives and mothers to go around. you see an increase in sexual violence. And already in northern India, you're starting to see the emergence of polyandry, in which, you know, one woman is married to two or three brothers, which is an absolutely brutal situation often for that woman.
Another area that is an area that I had not thought so much about, thinking about gender inequality in relationship to it, but it makes perfect sense once I read it in your book, is the AIDS pandemic in Africa. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the AIDS pandemic in Africa is increasingly feminized. It's increasingly a woman's issue. Most of the people who are victims of AIDS in Africa are women, and it's getting much worse. Among young people, five times as many young women as young men are infected. And part of that, I think people would be inclined to think at first that this is partly just biology and a function of biology, but that's not entirely the case. The differences also have to do with a whole host of different power imbalances between men and women. There's many parts of the continent where girls, having so few resources, having so little access to education, are absolutely dependent on much older men to take care of their needs. And you also will often find women entering into sugar daddy relationships just to pay for their schooling. You know, these kind of sugar daddy relationships are common enough that you see billboards in major cities warning against them as part of kind of AIDS prevention initiatives. There's also the fact that women in general cannot ask men to ask their husbands to use condoms. In Uganda, when a group of feminists or a group of women's rights activists tried to change some of the laws governing kind of family relationships and domestic life, and it was a whole host of different things, but one provision was that they were trying to pass a law that would have banned spousal rape. And people went crazy. People considered this absolutely outrageous. And in fact, one male parliamentarian argued that, in fact, the most violent thing a spouse could do was to deny sex to their partner. So you have a situation in many countries. You know, the United States for a long time was promoting abstinence, be faithful and use condoms, or use condoms if you absolutely must, but was promoting this as the main avenue of prevention. And condoms actually are a crucial part of the whole suite of options we have to address this pandemic. But this abstinence and be faithful message was in many ways a cruel joke for women who, A, had very little say sometimes about when and to whom they were married, no ability to deny sex to their husbands. There's parts of the continent where marriage itself is a primary risk factor for women in terms of their exposure to the disease. And, you know, the former United Nations special envoy on AIDS in Africa, who was appointed by Kofi Annan, said to me at one point that the struggle against the dehumanization of women, or the struggle for female equality, is the most important struggle on the face of the planet. And he was talking specifically about it being at the center of HIV and AIDS, although I think he would agree that it applies more broadly.
Yeah, you described a situation of a young woman or girl, I think maybe 14, who was raped by maybe a 35-year-old man, and then his family was the only place she could go, so right. She was sort of stuck.
Yeah, she got pregnant and afraid, you know, her own parents weren't going to support her, so she ended up going to live with her rapist as a kind of common law wife. She got pregnant every year. You know, she told me that she knew nothing about family planning. She'd never heard about family planning. So again, she got pregnant every year. And then he died after several years. And she found out that he had a locked case where he had been keeping his antiretrovirals. So he had been HIV positive for many years and never thought to mention this to her. She's taking care of 10 children right now, but some of those are orphans and nieces and nephews. But she had several children by him who are also all HIV positive. She's now taking care of, again, a friend's children as well as her sister's children, because they both have died of the disease. And she's, you know, an uneducated, strong and smart and kind of amazing, but a woman with no resources and such crushing responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Michelle Goldberg. The title of her latest book is The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. This is KBOO Portland. You begin pretty much the book with the case of Rosa or Rosita in Nicaragua. She was a 9-year-old girl who became pregnant and then became the focus of a national controversy there. Why did you start with her story?
I started with Nicaragua because I thought it was a way to show the intersection between international forces and kind of global religious forces and global political forces and local politics and then individual lives and how these things interact. And her story, I think, is particularly both poignant and horrible. And it's also fascinating because it's in many ways kind of ambiguous and doesn't seem ambiguous at first. At first, it seems like almost a parable of, you know, the pro-choice movement or the feminist movement. And then it becomes much more complicated. And those tend to be the stories that I'm interested in. And I tend to be more interested in some of the irreconcilable areas or some of the gray areas or the ambiguities when you're talking about all these different clashing and kind of swirling values and systems and things. And so basically the Rosita case, and Rosita is a pseudonym that everybody in Nicaragua uses. Rosita was a 9-year-old girl who was... She became pregnant when her family were working as migrant laborers in Costa Rica. Her mother took her daughter to a doctor, was kind of shocked to find out she was pregnant. The case eventually started getting a lot of media attention. It was, you know, a pregnant 9-year-old. And eventually, you know, Costa Rica, like most countries in Latin America, has quite strict anti-abortion laws. It soon the government was trying to intervene to make sure that she didn't have an abortion and that her parents didn't take her out of the country. Eventually, some feminists from Nicaragua, seeing both that this was a kind of terrible injustice and also seeing that this was a case which maybe could be used to spotlight their issues and to spotlight the need for liberalization, came, helped the mother and stepfather smuggle Rosita back to Nicaragua. Again, it was a huge cause celeb there with various forces struggling over this poor girl, you know, the hospital, the Catholic Church, the government, the feminist movement. Some people were saying that it was probably her stepfather who impregnated her in the first place. The feminist movement said, no, this is, you know, you're just slandering him. The man that she accused of raping her had been arrested in Costa Rica. And eventually it all ended with the feminists having to basically sneak her out the back door of a hospital, take her to a private home where 3 of the best OBGYNs in Nicaragua performed the abortion. And the fallout and the backlash from this case, even though public opinion was mostly on the side of Rosita and her family and the feminists, it so enraged conservative forces in Nicaragua that it was the beginning in certain ways of the mobilization that led in 2006 to an absolute ban on abortion in Nicaragua, even in cases where the woman's life is at stake. So you now have women, you know, hemorrhaging to death in Managua hospitals, ectopic pregnancies left untreated until a woman's fallopian tubes burst. It's this really horrific situation. And then the coda to all of this is that Rosita reemerged in the news not long ago, this time when her mother had accused her stepfather of raping her. It turned out that she got pregnant again not long after the abortion. You know, the stepfather went on the lam. He was eventually arrested, sentenced to 30 years in prison. And now the feminist movement there is kind of under investigation. And there's, you know, threats that they'll be persecuted for basically abetting him. And to be honest, although they truly didn't know, I believe, that... They truly kind of let their ideology blind them. It's not that they were trying to kind of trick people, but they did miss a chance to protect this girl from years more of really terrible abuse, you know, and did kind of substantial damage to their own cause as well.
And so what is her status now? Do you know?
No, I don't know. I mean, she has the... Last I know, she has a young child. She's living with her mother. Mm-hmm. The stepfather's in prison.
Central America, you mentioned El Salvador, you have Nicaragua. It's interesting that you've picked that particular area because we think now of Latin America as having so many countries that are becoming liberalized and radicalized in their political outlook. What about this whole issue of reproductive rights? How is it playing out in Central America and South America?
Well, sadly, it's often being neglected. You know, I mean, it certainly wasn't in Cuba. It took women's rights seriously. And you know, Cuba is the one country in Latin America with very liberal abortion laws. But I think that what you see, you know, regarding this new wave of so-called radical leaders is their utter indifference, if not hostility, to women's rights. And the prime example of that is Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. You know, Daniel Ortega, when he was leading the Sandinistas were a revolutionary force with a substantial number of female militants. You know, there were a lot of women fighting in that revolution. And he already betrayed them a bit when the Sandinistas first came to power. I remember one Sandinista woman was telling me that, you know, they had gone to him and presented him their demands for liberalized reproductive rights as well as some other. They did make things a little bit better for women, certainly. But when they presented their demands, she said he said to her something like, "That's going to have to wait until we've replaced all the martyrs of the revolution." And then what happened was that Daniel Ortega, of course, was swept from power and has been desperately trying to regain power. And to do so, he made a deal with the Catholic Church and the rising population of evangelicals in Nicaragua to push through this total abortion ban. And so right now, Daniel Ortega, the leader of the Sandinistas, is perhaps, you know, the kind of public enemy number one among a great many Nicaraguan feminists. And he's also, you know, the force behind these persecutions of feminists that are being kind of justified by their actions in the Rosita case.
I'm speaking with Michelle Goldberg. The title of her current book is The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. It's interesting, the conflict that you have to deal with to write about this between women's rights and traditional cultures. Mm-hmm. How do you come down on that, or how do you make peace with that whole controversy?
Well, I don't necessarily know that it's always possible to make peace with it. And I think that often people who work in this area would prefer to pretend that there isn't an inherent conflict sometimes between feminism and multiculturalism. You know, or between this kind of universal idea of individual rights and respecting cultural autonomy and local mores. But there really is. Almost every society in the world, as much as some people would like to believe that there are, you know, back in the mists of time, some kind of idyllic matriarchies, there's not that much evidence of them, and there's certainly not very many of them in existence today. Traditional societies tend to oppress women, as do modern societies to various degrees. But it's kind of a hallmark of modernization is often greater autonomy and self-determination for women, and kind of a flattening of sex hierarchies. And so again and again, you have, you know, this happened in Nicaragua, where the feminists who were getting support from, you know, various European NGOs and United Nations organizations are accused of being agents of imperialism, trying to undermine the traditional values of the people. Meanwhile, conservatives also have their own very powerful networks of international support, which not very long ago included the United States. And I would simply say that I tend to side with women who are working on the ground to change their own cultures from within, and who say that we have as much right to speak for our country, for our cultures, and we have as much of a right to change our cultures as you do to try to change yours, you know, and kind of pay us the respect of treating our cultures as capable of progress and as capable of evolution as you believe your own cultures to be. You know, and so I think it's a mistake to treat the most conservative voices or those who demand absolute stasis as the most authentic voices in a society, right? There is no such thing really as absolute cultural authenticity anymore. There are always going to be outside forces. There are always going to be various kinds of hybridizations, et cetera. And so there are times when these come into really thorny and difficult conflicts, and I describe some of those in my book. But ultimately, I tend to side almost instinctively, I think, with women who are working to overthrow the kind of oppressive strictures of their own societies. You know, those are the women I relate to in this society, and those are the women I relate to all over the world.
So someone, for instance, who's taken a lead role in speaking out and acting against female genital mutilation would be somebody whose cause you would be sympathetic toward.
Right. Again, and I would say that this is not something that we can do from outside. You know, outsiders cannot kind of march into these countries and say, you have to give up this practice right now. But they actually can support people like the grassroots activist. And in my book, I write about Agnes Pareo, who is a Kenyan woman from the Maasai community who was herself circumcised and is working very, very hard to end this practice within her own community. And she started a shelter called Tesaro Namontok, which means rescue the girls in the Maasai language. And girls are running away by the hundreds. Girls in little villages with very little communication with the outside world hear a little glimmer that there's something else out there, hear that there's this place that they can go where they won't be cut. Maasai girls are typically cut around 12 or 13, and then they're married off shortly after. And so these girls hear that there is another way, that they can stay in school, that Agnes will protect them. And, you know, they pack their bags and set out in the middle of the night across the bush to show up at Tesaro. It's really inspiring. And nobody could do this from outside. You know, nobody could make this kind of change from outside. But Agnes is supported to some extent, both by, you know, she gets some funding from outsiders, including the United Nations Population Fund. Eve Ensler has given her some money, the famous of the Vagina Monologues fame. And also, she's protected by the fact that during the 90s, Westerners got very exercised about female genital mutilation. It was the first time a lot of them had heard about it. There was, you know, shows on CNN. There was novels and books about it. And they pressured their governments to do something about it. And our governments and European governments and the United Nations put pressure on many African governments, which, again, is not the most democratic system in the world, but that is the system that we live in, you know, in which aid and trade creates power imbalances between countries that all sides work to exploit. So a lot of African countries banned the practice, although they did this in this kind of desultory way where they weren't actually trying, you know, they weren't actually really enforcing it. But the mere fact that there were bans meant that these parents couldn't, say, call the police on Agnes for kidnapping their daughters. I mean, it was these laws that protected Agnes. And so often the kind of dynamics I describe in this book are dynamics where the kind of international feminist movement or international human rights movement works in concert with activists trying to change things on the ground and are able to kind of leverage sources of power on behalf of those activists.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly an important thing to be writing about, and I appreciate your work in this area. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I want to tell people again that we've been speaking with Michelle Goldberg, who is the author of The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Portland.
That was a 2009 episode of Political Perspectives, interviewing journalist Michelle Goldberg on her book, The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World. This is KBOO's Women's Month series on every Friday in March at 6 p.m. This show is a part of KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. So if you'd like to support KBOO and great shows like the ones we featured today, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All the great programming coming up is online at kboo.fm/thrills. I'm Althea. Thanks for being with us. Thank you.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Get ready to dance all night. This Friday, March 11th, KBOO is bringing you Music That Moves You, a 12-hour dance party and benefit show. Tune in at 8 p.m. as DJ Kabloom and friends spin the sounds that will keep you moving all night. Grab your very own limited edition Music That Moves You collapsible water bottle. It's the perfect accessory for hydration on the move. So move on over to kboo.fm/moves, buy the bottle, tune in for the tunes, and support the community radio station that makes the movement, KBOO Portland.